Okay, we missed a week last week, so we want to pick up where we left off 2 weeks ago, and we were discussing Exodus 1 to 11, the deliverance from Egypt, and we were under theme on your lecture outline, which is the historical setting for the Exodus, or the problem of the date of the Exodus, to replace the Exodus in the 18th dynasty or the 19th dynasty. The 18th dynasty date is called an early date for the Exodus. The 19th dynasty date is called a late date for the Exodus. 2 weeks ago, we looked at some of the major arguments that have been advanced initially for the late date, and I think by far the strongest argument is the first one, Exodus 1:11, that says that the Israelites were placed in forced labor to build these store cities for the Pharaoh. Pharaoh, of course, not named, and that's part of the problem. But the store cities were by Pharaoh Ramesses. And of course, Ramesses was a 19th dynasty Pharaoh. So we discussed that. The additional arguments, I think, are less strong because they're largely either arguments from silence or inference kind of arguments. The second one was archaeological surveys of Transjordan by Nelson Gluck indicated, at least as far as he was concerned, that there wasn't sedentary population in Transjordan, that is, the areas of Moab and Ammon, for 5 centuries prior to 1300. So if you had an early date for the Exodus, there wouldn't have been a settled population in Moab. You read in Numbers that the Moabites came out and forced the Israelites to go around, and that they had fields and vineyards, and sounds like a sedentary population at the time of the Exodus and conquest. Third argument was on the basis of destruction levels in certain Canaanite cities that are mentioned in the book of Joshua as having been taken by Joshua at the time of the conquest. And those destruction levels were in the time of 1250 to 1200, which is the end of what's called the Late Bronze Age there. Now, of course, then the question becomes, who was the agent of destruction? Was it the Israelites at the time of the conquest? Well, that's an assumption. You know, it might have been, but it's by no means certain. But that's one of the arguments for the late date, those destruction levels, the end of the Late Bronze Age. The fourth argument is an argument from silence. There's no reference in the book of Judges to the Palestinian campaigns of the pharaohs Seti and Ramesses. We know Seti and Ramesses marched their armies through the line of Canaan. Well, if the conquest had taken place in the 1400s, you've been in the period of Judges at the time of Seti and Ramesses. Why isn't there a reference to these armies going through? You have reference to other oppressing peoples, no reference to the Egyptians. And then the last thing I mentioned really isn't an argument for the late date, but it sets a terminus for the late date, because there's a reference in what's called the Merneptah inscription to places that Merneptah took in the land of Canaan. He mentions Israel, so sometimes it's called the Israel stele or the Merneptah stele. That can be dated to the 5th year of his reign, approximately 1220. So you would say, as far as a late terminus for the late date, can't push it down below 1220 on the basis of extra biblical references to Israel being in Canaan by 1220. Toward the end of our last session, I went to arguments for the early date, the 18th dynasty date. And again, the first argument I think is the strongest, and that's based on the text of 1 Kings 6:1, which says, 480 years after the Exodus, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign, he began to build the temple. We can date the fourth year of Solomon's reign. 966, 967. 480 years gives you 1446. So then you'd be back to the time of Thutmose and Amenhotep, as far as the Pharaoh repression and the Pharaoh of the Exodus. The second argument that we looked at was that Thutmose III was a great builder with a long lifespan. We know that he put a lot of people to work in his building project. And we know he had a long lifespan, which fits with the chronology of Moses' long lifespan. So that's the second argument. Used to be said there's no evidence of 18th dynasty construction up in the Delta area, way up in the northern part of Egypt, but in the 1990s, evidence has been found of 18th dynasty construction up in that area. So that kind of counters that argument. The third argument we looked at, again, which is not real strong, is the references to Habiru, people called Habiru, in the Amarna letters, which are letters between city-state kings of the land of Canaan and the Egyptian pharaoh, that talk about attacks by these people called the Habiru. And then the question becomes, are the Habirus Hebrews? And there are a lot of people who tended to sound a lot alike, equate Hebrew and Habiru. I think I mentioned last week K.A. Kitchen's statement that the Hebrews may have been Habiru, but not all Habiru are Hebrew. Habiru seemed to be more a social class rather than an ethnic group. And they seem to have been these nomadic kind of people that wanders around, settled from time to time, were mercenary in character. But they're all over the Middle East. For a long span of time, a lot of places, there are Habiru in Egypt after the Hebrews left. So that whole issue is not altogether clear, although some have attempted to use it as support for an early date for the conquest by equating the Habiru with the Amarna letters to the Hebrew. I think that's about where we stop. There's one additional argument I want to mention that has sometimes been used, but again, which is not totally clear or unchallenged, and that is an argument from excavations at Jericho, the city that Joshua took immediately after crossing the Jordan River and entering the land of Canaan. And there's been a long history of excavation at that site. Initially, excavations were done by Germans in the early 1900s. Later, in the 1930s, by an Englishman named John Garstang. And John Garstang concluded that the city was destroyed at about 1400 BC. And if you took his case for that, you would say, well, that fits. 1446, time of the Exodus, 40 years in the wilderness, come up the land of Canaan, you're about 1400. So after the 1930s, there was a fair degree of consensus. Archaeology has corroborated the conquest at precisely the time the Bible says. But then you come along in the 1950s, and there's another English archaeologist by the name of Kathleen Kenyon, K-E-N-Y-O-N. And Kathleen Kenyon did a lot of excavations there, and she came to the conclusion that the level of the site that Garstang assigned to the time of the conquest was wrongly done, and she concluded that that level was really a destruction at about 2300 B.C., so long before any possible time that the Israelites could have been the agents of that destruction. And then she said, after that 2300 BC destruction, the city was rebuilt, and was then again destroyed at the end of the Middle Bronze Age. You see, the Middle Bronze Age is 2000 to 1500. She said it was destroyed again at about 1580. See, that's shortly before the end of the Middle Bronze Age. Well, that would have been also prior to the time of the Israelite conquest on the basis of the Nero group. But she said subsequent to that, the site was really unoccupied to any significant level from 1500 down to 1200. So her work raised a host of questions about, particularly the conclusion Garstang had come to, and then the question whether archaeology supports or doesn't support an Israelite conquest almost at any time. Because down at 1200, you would think even there there would have been a more significant settlement on the site. I passed out a sheet that is a photocopy of a short article in Time magazine, looks like this, while you were taking your quiz. That article, if you notice at the bottom, was published in Time on March 5th, 1990. You all have that? Some of you didn't get it. What happened here? Did I miss a row or didn't you pass it down? What the article is, let me get the bibliography here. What the article in Time magazine is a brief summary of an article published in BAR, that's Biblical Archaeology Review, it's on page 3 of your bibliography, written by Bryant G. Boyd, entitled, Did the Israelites Conquer Jericho? What Bryant Boyd did was go back over the reports published by Kathleen Kenyon on her work, her excavations at Jericho. Kathleen Kenyon, by the time Wood wrote his article, was already long gone. She died in 1978. She lived from 1906 to 1978. She was director of the British School of Archaeology in Jerusalem, certainly a respected scholar. She published her findings from the excavations she did at Jericho, drew her conclusions. Brian Wood went back over her published excavation reports and used those reports to draw different conclusions from the evidence than Kathleen Kenyon had drawn. So if you look at that summary of Brian Wood's article, you really ought to go to Brian Wood's article and read the whole article, but if you're interested. But from his summary, you notice in the end of that first paragraph, the writer of this article says the late British archaeologist Kathleen Kenyon established in the 1950s that while the ancient city was indeed destroyed, it happened around 1550 BC, some 150 years before Joshua could have shown up. But archaeologist Brian Wood, writing in March-April issue of Biblical Archaeology Review, claims Kenyon was wrong. Based on a reevaluation of her research, which was published in detail only recently, Wood says the city's walls could have come tumbling down at just the right time to match the biblical account. Now they put a say that a comment there doesn't prove the event happened. I don't think that's so much the point here. Just looking to see what kind of evidence there is or isn't. But the next paragraph, Kenyon's dating of Jericho's destruction was based largely on the fact that she failed to find a type of decorative pottery imported from Cyprus that was popular in the region around 1400 BC. Now notice again, that's negative evidence. She didn't find something. It's not that she did find something. It's what she didn't find. Its absence, she reasoned, meant the city had long since become uninhabited. But Wood, an ancient pottery expert, argues that Kenyon's excavations were made in a poorer part of the city where the expense of imported pottery would have have been absent in any case. And he says that other pottery dug up in Jericho in the 1930s was common in 1400 BC. So you get into a discussion of the evidence, and to some extent into this question, there's absence of evidence, evidence of absence. Just because you don't find it, does that mean there isn't any there? You know, may have been a lot of it that wasn't found. And he gives other reasons for coming to the conclusion that it was destroyed around 1400. If you look at the third column, second paragraph, talks about radiocarbon dating, but then at the end of that, Egyptian amulets found Jericho graves can be dated around 1400 BC. So it sounds like it was inhabited around 1400. And Wood says, looks to me as though the biblical stories are true. So that discussion really is ongoing. I might say, we'll come back to that when we look at the book of Joshua in the early chapters where it speaks about the taking of Jericho. We'll look at it in a little more detail. But I want to mention just at this point, most of the late Bronze Age materials, 1500 to 1200, of the Jericho mound have been removed either by erosion and simply mining of whatever was there by people who parted their stuff away, as well as archaeological work on the mound, particularly the early Germans who disturbed the mound and didn't have the kind of methods that we have today to record everything and take pictures of everything. And a lot of that area, that late bronze area of that mound, is gone and will never be recovered. So I think it's going to be difficult to come to any hard and firm conclusions on the basis of dating the destruction of Jericho. But if you agree with John Gerstang's original conclusions and then Brian G. Wood's conclusions drawn from the reports of Kathleen Kenyon, we come up in the 1400s for the conquest of Jericho. So those are the arguments for Earl and Red Dates. And I think you can see we could spend a lot of time on each one of them going into much more detail. I don't think it warrants time in this course to do that. I think you can see from what we've said, this is going to be an ongoing discussion. I don't think there's any conclusive sort of argument on either side. So the discussion will go on. I want to just mention a couple things that, at least in my mind, kind of weigh the balance of evidence toward an early date conclusion. I am inclined to think the time was the 18th dynasty rather than the 19th dynasty. And a couple of comments in that regard. First thing I want to mention is the chronology of the period of the judges is much more difficult to harmonize with a late date than it is with an early date. And the reason for that is, if you take a late date, say 1290 for the Exodus. 1290 for the Exodus, 966 for the fourth year of Solomon's reign. You only have 324 years to work with. 324 years. For a late date, 324 years between the time of the Exodus, 1290 and 966. If you take the early date, 1446 to 966, you have 480 years. If you look at the book of Judges and add up all the chronological references in the book of Judges, you know, of times of oppression and rest, oppression, rest, oppression, rest, you will get a total of 410 years. And then you have to add that, the time from Eli to Solomon's fourth year. Eli was a judge at the beginning of 1 Samuel. So you have Eli, you have Saul, you have David, and you go on to Solomon. That is another 116 years, minimally. You have to add the years of the wilderness wandering. There's another 40 years. And you have to add the time of Joshua after the time of the conquest. You said, all the book of Joshua and the life of, say you add another 10 years. What have you got there? You've got 576 years. Now, obviously, the real problem here is those chronological figures in the book of Judges. There must have been overlap between the times of oppression and rest, and there must have been more regional kinds of situations than national. And that's fine. You see, if you have 576 years, that doesn't fit into 480 either. Even with the early date for the Exodus, you have to have overlaps. You have to compress. My point is, it's much more difficult to compress that 576 down into 324 than it is into 480. So it seems to me the chronology of the book of Judges at least points you toward more likely an early date for the Exodus rather than a late date for the Exodus. You follow that? Any question on that? Second comment. One of the arguments for the late dates that we mentioned 2 weeks ago was the destruction levels of Canaanite cities, the end of the late Bronze Age, 1250 to 1200, as being evidence for the Israelite conquest at that time. That argument's increasingly coming into question. You read Merle, he questions that. One of the questions there on the quiz, how many cities were said to be destroyed, explicitly destroyed and burned? Three. What are they? Yeah, those three. That's all. It says that others he conquered and killed the people. It doesn't say he destroyed the city. So people are beginning to talk, people like Merle and many others, about a modified conquest group in the sense that when Israel came in the conquest, they didn't completely destroy all these cities. They went in and settled down in these cities and lived in them and killed the inhabitants. But you shouldn't be looking for destruction levels in all those cities. So then the question is, who were the agents of destruction in 1250 to 1200? Well, all you can do is speculate. If you go back to that 19th dynasty, Merneptah, that has that inscription about Israel being in the land of Canaan, talks about raids up into the land of Canaan. Maybe some of them were destroyed by Merneptah. At about 1200, there was an attack on Egypt by what are called the Sea Peoples. Most think they came from Crete. Those Sea Peoples were repulsed by the Egyptians. In other words, the Egyptians forced them off. They came up and they settled on the southern coast of the land of Canaan, today in the area of Gaza. They became the Philistines. And of course, we know the Philistines were a problem with Israel in their time were judges, but that was about 1,200. Maybe the Philistines were the agents of destruction of when they came in and settled, of some of those towns. Maybe some of those sites were destroyed by the Israelites with struggles with the Canaanites during the period of the judges. They'd already been settled in the land. It's hard to say, but I don't think you can say that the destruction levels of those cities at 1250 to 1200 necessarily is a strong argument for the late date for the Exodus. So that is being increasingly questioned. If you look at Hatzor, for example, one of the sites that is said to have been destroyed by Joshua, there are destruction levels at Hatzor at 1400 1300 and 1230. Now, it's often been argued that this 1230 destruction level is the time of the Israelite conquest. But that's not the only destruction level at Hatzor. Why not say it's up here? There's no, you go in these destruction levels, there's no signposts that say this city was destroyed by whoever. It's an open question. Now, one further comment on this, and this is where this stuff really gets complicated. There's a book listed in your bibliography by John Bimson. That's on page 2. Called Redating the Exodus and the Conquest. John Bimson wrote a book-length treatment of this in which he gets into very technical arguments, but the point of his argument is to change the dating of the archaeological period in Canaan. I have on that overhead there the traditional way of dating archaeological periods. And how you establish periods is a complex matter in itself. But what he argues is that the Middle Bronze Age, which traditionally ends at 1500, should be pushed down closer to 1400 than 1500. So the date of the end of the Middle Bronze Age would be lowered by a century, approximately. Now, there are destruction levels at a number of these sites at the end of the Middle Bronze Age. And if you lower the date of the Middle Bronze Age down into 1400, then those destruction levels at the end of the Middle Bronze Age would be moved down into the 1400s. And you see, in that way, even Kathleen Kenyon's 1530 date for the destruction of Jericho, you lower the end of the Middle Bronze Age, it's going to be down in the 1400s. And that is an ongoing discussion and an argument. But I think, by way of conclusion, if you look at your citations, page 7, there are several paragraphs, middle of the page down to the bottom, from an essay by founder of this institution, Alan McRae, on this question of date of the Exodus. I'm not going to read those paragraphs, but if you go over to page 8, his last paragraph there on page 8, he says, the arguments as to an earlier late day of the Exodus often seem to be given in the manner of a lawyer determined to prove a particular point rather than of a researcher seeking for light in order to determine something that is yet not known. Some new discovery may make the matter absolutely final, but up to the present it must be considered a question on which we do not yet have sufficient light. Now, he wrote that many years ago. I don't think this situation has changed radically since that time. If anything, I think evidence has moved toward the early date conclusion. But I think what he is arguing for is proper methodology and mental attitude towards issues of this sort. And I think he's right. We should be looking for information that might help to clarify the picture rather than get on the crusade if you don't agree with an early date for the Exodus, then some people suggested you don't really take the Bible seriously because 1 Kings 6:1 says it was 480 years after the Exodus the 4th year of Solomon's reign. Argument finished. It was in 1446. No debate. There are people like that who will discuss an issue with that manner. So I think his approach is the proper approach. Any questions, comments on this? I don't want to spend too much time on it. Yeah. John Benson, on lowering the date of the end of the Mo Brown Bridge. Look. Yeah. Page 2 of your bibliography. All right, let's go on to C, which is the oppression, Exodus 1:1 to 2:25, and we'll get into the biblical text here. If you look at the oppression in those first two chapters of Exodus, as well as you notice chapter 5, 1:1 to 2:25, plus chapter 5, where you have the reference to making bricks with straw or without straw, I think what you see is there were several phases of oppression over a period of time. The reason that the Egyptians felt they should put the Israelites to work was because of their multiplication in numbers. You read in verse 7, the Israelites were fruitful and multiplied greatly and became exceedingly numerous. So the land was filled with them. What that statement tells us is that what had been going on in the late chapters of Genesis, if you look at Genesis 47:27, you read that when Joseph went down into Egypt, and then his brothers and his father eventually followed him there and settled down. You read verse 27 of Genesis 47. The Israelites settled in Egypt in the region of Goshen. They acquired property there and were fruitful and increased greatly in number. So already you see in the time of Joseph, it's telling you the Israelites are increasing. There's a 400-year period between the end of Genesis and the opening of Exodus. And in 1:7 of Exodus, it says they are becoming exceedingly numerous. So the Pharaoh says in verse 10, come, we must deal shrewdly with them, or they will become even more numerous, and if a war breaks out, we'll join our enemies, fight against us, and leave the country. Now, I think what's interesting there is they really don't want them to leave the country. They want them to stay there, but they want to exploit them and use them and benefit from their presence, but they want to control them. So they determine to put slave masters over them. Verse 11, they put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labor. And that's the first phase, you might say, of the oppression, hard bondage. Now, some have said this oppression is the first example of anti-Semitism in human history, something that's been going on from that point until today. It's remarkable how that seems to be something that is still with us. Well, you might say that, but I think there's more than that, something deeper and more significant than just anti-Semitism. I think at root what you find here is an expression of something rooted back in Genesis 3:15. after the fall into sin. God says, I will put enmity between the seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent, Satan. We have that kingdom of God, the kingdom of Satan. You have two kingdoms that are at clash and at enmity with each other. And here's a manifestation of that enmity between those two peoples. So the first step of that first phase is to put slave masters over the Israelites to afflict them so that they won't become too numerous or powerful that they could become a threat to Israel's own security by siding with Israel's enemies. But the problem is, as soon as they do that, what happens? Verse 12. The more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread. So the effort didn't work. So the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites. So what do? That first phase of the oppression as a second step, they turn the screws down further. They oppress them more. Verse 14. They made their lives bitter with hard labor and brick and mortar, with all kinds of work in the field, and all their hard labor, the Egyptians used them ruthlessly. In other words, they increased the oppression, hoping to control the multiplication of the Israelites. So they make the bondage more severe. So the first phase is hard bondage in two steps. But that doesn't work. So there's a second phase of oppression, and that is killing the male children. And again, you get two steps. First step is in verse 16. The Pharaoh tells the Hebrew midwives, when you help the Hebrew women in childbirth and observe them on the delivery stools, the boy, kill them. But if it's a girl, let her live. And at least they thought they could control the sexual or the military threat by killing the males. But again, that is frustrated because the Hebrew midwives don't cooperate. You read the next verse, the midwives feared God, did not do what the king of Egypt had told them to do. They let the boys live. So you get a second step there. And instead of just these midwives being instructed to kill the male children of the Hebrews, you read verse 18, the king summoned and asked them why. And then in verse 22, Pharaoh gave this order to all his people, every boy that is born, you must throw into the Nile, but let every girl do. So in 122, that command to kill male children is extended to all the Egyptian people, to cast every male child. Doesn't say explicitly every Hebrew male child, but I think in the context, that's what is in focus and what it is in reference to. Every Hebrew male child cast into the Nile River. So two steps again. Nahum Sarna, who writes the Exodus commentary in the Jewish Publication Society, five-volume commentary on the Pentateuch, called the Torah commentary, makes this comment. Faced with a conflict between the laws of God and those of Pharaoh, the midwives followed the dictates of conscience. Their defiance of tyranny constitutes history's first reported act of civil disobedience in defense of a moral imperative. That's an interesting statement. Civil disobedience in defense of a moral imperative. Pharaoh tells the midwives, kill all those male children, and it says they feared God and did not do what the king of Egypt told them to do, to let the birds live. He goes on to say, it stated they were actuated by fear of God, a phrase frequently associated with moral and ethical behavior. Fear of God connotes a conception of God as one who makes moral demands on humankind. It functions as the ultimate restraint on evil and the supreme stimulus for good. Here it goes. Stimulus for good. Ultimate restraint on evil. We do away with God and where there's no restraint. But you notice what happens here. All these efforts are frustrated. So that after that command to all Egyptians, throw any male child into the Nile River, what happens? Moses is put in. And he's put in that basket, and his life is preserved, and he grows up in the house of the Pharaoh and ultimately becomes the leader who delivers Israel out of the Egyptian death. So you see the futility of these efforts of the Egyptians to control the Israelites among them. I mentioned here chapter 5 as another chapter that is part of the oppression. And Exodus chapter 5 is after Moses comes back and asks for Pharaoh for permission to go into the wilderness and worship the Lord. And he doesn't grant that permission. But what's he do? You read in verse 6 of chapter 5, the same day Pharaoh gave this order to the slave drivers and foremen in charge of the people, you are no longer to supply the people with straw for making bricks. Let them go gather their own straw, but require them to make the same number of bricks as before. Don't reduce the quota. So apparently straw was used in some way in making the bricks. And it was supplied. But now because of this request, Pharaoh intensifies the oppression by not providing the straw, telling them to go out and find their own straw. You go down to verse 12, you read, the people scattered all over Egypt to gather stubble to use for straw. The slave drivers kept pressing them, saying, complete the work required of you for each day, just as when you had straw. And the foreman appointed by Pharaoh's slave drivers were beaten, were asked, why didn't you meet your quota bricks yesterday, the day before? Verse 18, you will not be given any straw. You must produce your full quota of bricks. So you have this chapter about the way the oppression was intensified by withholding straw, Israelites being forced to get their own straw, and sometimes having used double instead of straw, which raises the question of what was the function of the straw in the making of the bricks? If you look at pages 8, bottom of page 8, over to page 11 in your citation, I'm not going to read it. You can read it at your own leisure. This is taken from that same essay on, oh no, it isn't, it's a different one, The Relation of Archaeology to the Bible by Alan Hayden McRae, where he discusses this. And what he points out from that is that it used to be thought straw was used as a binding agent. In other words, if you had a long piece of, or pieces of straw going through a clay brick, it would kind of hold the clay together as a binding agent. But the problem with that was, how stubble function that was. What's the point if you can't get, you know, long strands of straw, what's the point of putting stubble on it? And he cites some scientific experiments that indicate that the placing of organic matter in certain types of clay makes the clay more workable, more plasticity, by means of some chemical reaction. And what McRae suggests at the end of this is that the Egyptians had discovered something that may not understood all the chemistry of it, but that if you mixed organic matter with clay, it made the clay more workable. And it made it easier then to mold bricks out of clay than if you didn't have organic material in it. So it's just an interesting side feature to that third intensification of oppression on Israel. So that's all under the oppression, 1.1 to 2.25 in chapter 5. Look at your citations, page 11. Bottom of the page, J. Motier, in some unpublished lectures called Old Testament Covenant Theology, makes this statement about this oppression. He says, even more significant than the actual occurrence of the word covenant is the situation in which the book of Exodus is set. I've already mentioned the genocidal impulses of Pharaoh. This is the content of chapter 1. The king of the world, Pharaoh, had determined on utter destruction of his people. Now, I don't think Pharaoh did determine on utter destruction. I think he wanted to control and avoid that. But I don't think that really affects so much Motier's point here. He says, little did he know that he was in this way challenging the promise that God had made to Abraham. In other words, the most fundamental reality about the people of Israel. For at the beginning of God's dealing with Abraham, as he then was in chapter 12, there was the promise of the preservation of Abraham and his descendants. God said, I will bless those who bless you, and him who curses you, I will curse. Pharaoh, therefore, all unwitting, was setting himself up to challenge the covenant. He was oppressing the very people, but God said, whoever blesses you, I will bless. Whoever curses you, I will curse. When his covenant was challenged, God rose to defend it. There are really covenantal issues involved in what's going on here. Therefore, both in its vocabulary and also in its chosen setting, proclaimed to us, the book of Exodus is the continuation of the covenant narrative. In other words, that promise given to Abraham that God would raise up a seed to Abraham and a nation would come out of Abraham and that he would put his blessing on that nation. That's continuing on. That is still something that is very actual in all this interaction between the Egyptians and the Israelites in the early chapters of Exodus. Okay, any questions on the oppression? One to D. D is the deliverer, Exodus 3, 1 to 7:13. And of course, the deliverer is Moses, who was born right after that final phase of the, or that killing of the male children at the end of chapter 1. Chapter 2, Moses is born and becomes the leader who delivers Israel out of Egypt. Moses is certainly one of the greatest personalities of all of the Bible. You know, when you think of Moses, think of Abraham, Moses, David, probably in the Old Testament, and Christ in the New Testament. But he's one of the great personalities of all of human history. I don't think there's any question about that. His historicity, that is his real existence as a historical person in the historical context in which these narratives are set, I would say today is generally accepted, but not completely. In other words, there's still Bible critics around who question whether or not Moses was a real historical figure or some sort of legendary, mythical creation of some ancient storyteller. John Van Cedars, who is a very active Old Testament scholar, written a number of books, in the article in the Encyclopedia of Religion, published in 1987, on the article on Moses, he says, the quest for the historical Moses is a futile exercise. He now belongs only to legend. In other words, there's an example of somebody who doesn't think Moses ever lived. The German scholars Martin Noth and Gerhard von Rad, both who wrote histories of Israel, ascribe a relatively minor role to Moses. They feel Israel became a nation constituted as such only in the land of Canaan. He didn't have a people that, in a mass exodus like Egypt, and came up into the land of Canaan. So you have these kinds of negative critics around. But if you look at your citations, page 12, second entry there is from the third edition of John Bright's History of Israel. John Bright was a student of William Foxwell Albright. He wrote the History of Israel. I think it's now in the fourth edition. But a pretty standard text on the history of Israel. And notice what he says. He says, though we know nothing of his career, save what the Bible tells us. In other words, there are no extra biblical references to Moses. That's one of the reasons his existence is questioned. Although we know nothing of his career, save what the Bible tells us, the details of which we have no means of testing, there can be no doubt that he was, as the Bible portrays him, the great founder of Israel's faith. Attempts to reduce him are extremely unconvincing. The events of the Exodus and Sinai require a great personality behind them and a faith as unique as Israel demands a founder. As surely as does Christianity or Islam, for that matter. Can you think of Christianity without Christ? Can you conceive of Islam without Muhammad? How can you conceive of Judaism without a Moses? Same issue. To deny that role to Moses would force us to posit another person of the same name. Actually, we do know quite a bit about the life of Moses. Admittedly, based entirely on the biblical record. But why should the biblical record be disqualified as a source of information about the life of an individual significant as Moses? We'll come across quite a bit of material as we progress further about things Moses was involved with. I think as far as his significance or importance, Boss puts it pretty well, again on page 12 of your citations, in his biblical theology, where he looks at Moses both retrospectively and prospectively. He says he was retrospectively considered instrumental in bringing the great patriarchal promises to an incipient fulfillment, at least in their external provisional embodiment. Israel became in truth a great nation. That was the promise to Abraham. And this was due not exclusively to their rapid increase. The organization received through Moses enabled them to attain national coherence. Moses likewise led them to the border of the promised land. The Lord had promised Abraham that territory is one of the kingdom. Moses came right to the verge of entrance into the promised land, up the cross of salt, didn't actually enter. So retrospectively, he brings those patriarchal promises to incipient fulfillment, prospectively considered, going forward. Moses occupies a dominant place in the religious development of the Old Testament. He is placed not merely at the head of the succession of prophets, but over them in advance. There is no prophet like Moses. He was a prophet, but the greatest of all the prophets. His authority extends over subsequent ages. The later prophets do not create anything new. They only predict something new. The later prophets call Israel back to the foundations Moses laid. Now, they do say certain things about what God is going to do in the future, beyond their own time. But fundamentally, they call Israel back to the Mosaic foundation. It is true Moses can be coordinated with the prophets. Nevertheless, the prophets themselves are clearly conscious of the unique position of Moses. They put his works not so much on a line with their own as with the stupendous eschatological work of Jehovah for his people expected in the latter days. According to Numbers 12:7, Moses was set over all God's house. It's entirely in keeping with this prospective import of Moses and his work that his figure acquires typical proportions to an unusual degree. He may fitly be called the Redeemer of the Old Testament. And of course, in that sense, he's pointing forward to Christ. nearly all the terms in use for redemption of the New Testament can be traced back to his time. We're going to work out that a bit as we go further. Because redemption was certainly a very significant thing in what's going on in the Exodus and the deliverance of the people. So those comments about Moses. Any question, comment there? It's going to E then. The plagues. Exodus 7:14 to 11:10. I might mention, I don't think I have that on the outline. The plagues are also described in poetic narrative in Psalm 78:43-51. Psalm 78:43-51. And Psalm 105:27-36. They're historical psalms that go back in poetic form, recount events of Israel's history, and of course the Exodus was the significant event that led to the formation of Israel as a nation. So, it's been common to refer to these series of miraculous occurrences that led to Pharaoh's release of the Israelites from bondage. It's been common to refer to them as plagues. And that is a term that's used in the biblical text. If you look at 9:14, you read, "For this time I will send the full force of my plagues against you and against your officials, your people." The full force of my plagues. That's a word that comes from Nagash, Nun Gimel Pei. But more often, these, quote, plagues are referred to in the biblical text as either signs or wonders. Sign is oath. Wonder is mofet. NIV, it's interesting, translates that sometimes wonder, sometimes it translates it miracle. But signs and wonders are used more often than plague to designate the series of divine interventions that lead to Israel's exodus from Egypt. And I think that language, sign and wonder, is helpful because it gives us more insight into the significance and intent of these events. When you ask what was God doing and what was his intent in bringing these series of events on the Egyptians and the Israelites, I think you have to start with looking at Moses' request to Pharaoh to let the Israelites go into the wilderness and worship. In chapter 5, the first few verses. Because in chapter 5, you read, Moses and Aaron went to Pharaoh and said, "This is what Yahweh," and NIV says the Lord, but that's in caps. And that's the Yod-Heh-Wah-Heh, the proper name of Israel's deity. Perhaps we don't know how it's pronounced because we don't know the vowel point yet. But perhaps something like Yahweh. They go to Pharaoh and say, "This is what Yahweh, the God of Israel, says. Let my people go so that they may hold a festival with me in the desert." What's Pharaoh's response? Pharaoh says, "Who is Yahweh that I should obey him and let Israel go? I do not know Yahweh, and I will not let Israel go." If you go to chapter 7, verse 3, there the Lord says, "I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and though I multiply my miraculous signs and wonders in Egypt, he will not listen to you. Then I will lay my hand on Egypt with mighty acts of judgment. I will bring out my divisions, my people, the Israelites, And the Egyptians will know that I am Yahweh when I stretch out my hand against Egypt and bring the Israelites out of it. In other words, why this series of signs and wonders? Pharaoh had said, I don't know Yahweh. Why should I let you go worship Yahweh? I don't know who he is. These things are done so that Pharaoh will know who Yahweh is. That he exists, that he's powerful. And that becomes a theme that really runs through here. The plagues are Yahweh's answer to Pharaoh's question in 5:2. Who is Yahweh? I don't know Yahweh. Look at, we looked at 7:5. Look at 7:16 and 7:2. Then say to him, Pharaoh, Yahweh, the God of the Hebrews, has sent me to say to you, let my people go so they may worship me in the desert. But until now you've not listened. This is what Yahweh says. By this you will know that I am Yahweh. Who is Yahweh? I don't know Yahweh. Look at 9:13 and follows. The Lord said to Moses, get up early morning, confront Pharaoh, say to him, this is what Yahweh, the God of the Hebrews, says, let my people go so they may worship me, or this time I will send the full force of my plagues against you, against your officials, your people. Why? So that you may know there is no one like me in all the earth. Verse 16, for I could have stretched out my hand, struck you and your people with a plague that would have wiped you off the earth. He could have done that instantaneously. He didn't have to go through a series of 10 plagues. But I have raised you up for this very purpose, that I might show you my power, and that my name might be proclaimed in all the earth. Yahweh is going to demonstrate who he is, and that he is powerful, so that Pharaoh can do nothing else but recognize that he exists and that he is powerful. Look at verse 27 of chapter 9. Pharaoh summoned Moses and Aaron. This time I have sinned, he said. Yahweh is in the right. I and my people are in the wrong. Pray to Yahweh, for we have had enough thunder and hail. I will let you go. Moses replied, when I have gone out of the city, I will spread out my hands in prayer to Yahweh. The thunder will stop. There will be no more hail. So what? So you may know that the earth is Yahweh. But I know that you and your officials still do not fear the Lord God, Yahweh. So, the plagues are a demonstration to Pharaoh of the existence and power of Yahweh, because in that first encounter with Moses, he said, I don't know who Yahweh is. But it wasn't just a demonstration to the Egyptians. It was also a demonstration to the Israelites. Look at chapter 10, the first few verses. The Lord said to Moses, go to Pharaoh, for I have hardened his heart and hearts of his officials, so I may perform these miraculous signs of mine among them, and that you may tell your children and grandchildren how I dealt harshly with the Egyptians and how I performed my signs among them, and that you may know that I am Yahweh. In other words, it's not just the Egyptians who are to learn from this who Yahweh is. It's the Israelites as well, so that they can experience God's existence and power and then pass that on down through the generations to their children, so that you may know that I am Yahweh. Look at Deuteronomy 4:34, where Moses later is commenting about this. He says, in Deuteronomy 4:34, has any God ever tried to take for himself one nation out of another nation by testings, by miraculous signs and wonders? By war, by a mighty hand and outstretched arm, or by great and awesome deeds, like all the things Yahweh your God did for you in Egypt before your very eyes. Then notice verse 35. This is a striking statement. You were shown these things, what? So that you might know that Yahweh is God. Besides him, there is no other. You were shown these things so that you might know that Yahweh is God. And then that added statement, which is striking at this point in Old Testament Revelation, that's monotheism, clear and simple. That is as strong a statement you find anywhere. Besides him, there is no other. There is only one God. Now, you know, the Israelites needed this. If you go back to chapter 5, you know, the question was put to Pharaoh at the beginning of chapter 5. And Pharaoh says, I don't know yet, right? And then that oppression was intensified by forcing them to make St. Paul's bricks without straw. And the Israelites don't like that. So you go down to the end of the chapter, you see in verse 21, these foremen of the labor forces come to Moses and Aaron and say, may the Lord look upon you and judge you. You've made us a stench to Pharaoh and his officials, put a sword in their hand to kill us. Moses returned to the Lord and said, oh Lord, why have you brought trouble upon this people? Is this why you sent me? Ever since I went to Pharaoh to speak your name, he's brought trouble upon this people. He's not rescued your people at all. And over in chapter 6, verse 9, Moses reported this to the Israelites. They did not listen to him because of their discouragement before bondage. The Israelites were discouraged. And the Lord was going to demonstrate to them his existence and his power by delivering them through this process. So when you speak of these signs and wonders, oath is the word in Hebrew for sign. And TDOT, Theological Dictionary, Old Testament, Volume 1, under oath, says, sign is an action, an occurrence, an event by which a person recognizes, learns, remembers, or perceives the authenticity of something. That's what's going on here. Both Pharaoh and Israel are learning about the authenticity of something through what's going on. These four plagues, which are signs and wonders. The authenticity of the authenticity of the other itself. Okay. There are 10 plagues. They are arranged in 3 sets of 3. Climaxing in the 10th plague, which is the death of the first one. Let me see what time. Well, let me get a few more minutes and we'll get to it. So you have the first 9 plagues arranged in 3 groups of 3 plagues each, with the climax in the 10th plague, the death of the first one. The first plague in each group, in other words, number 1, 4, and 7, is introduced by a warning given to Pharaoh early in the morning as he went to the Nile River. And you see that in 7:15, where it says, go to the Pharaoh in the morning as he goes out to the water. Wait on the bank of the Nile to meet him. That's the instruction to Moses. You find that in 7:15, 8:20. Then Then the Lord said to Moses, get up early in the morning, confront Pharaoh as he goes to the water, and say to him. And 9:13, the Lord said to Moses, get up early in the morning, confront Pharaoh, and say to him, this is what the Lord God of Hebrews said. So you get the same introductory phrase for the first each of those sets of three. The second plague in each group, which would be 2, 5, and 8, is also introduced by a warning. But delivered to the Pharaoh, presumably at his palace, set it out by the Nile. You find that in 8:1, 9:1, and 10:1. 8:1, the Lord said to Moses, go to Pharaoh and say to him. 9:1, the Lord said to Moses, go to Pharaoh and say to him. 10:1, the Lord said to Moses, go to Pharaoh, for I have hardened his heart. The last plague in each group, 3, 6, and 9, seems to have commenced without any warning. In 8:16, you read, then the Lord said to Moses, tell Aaron, stretch out your staff, strike the dust of the ground throughout all the land of Egypt, the dust will become next. He just does it. 9:8. The Lord said to Moses, Aaron, take handfuls of soot from a furnace, have Moses toss it in the air, the presence of Pharaoh, it will become fine dust over the land of Egypt, festering boils will break out on men and animals throughout the land. So he just does that. And 10:21. Those who ignored the word of the Lord left their slaves. Oh, I'm still in line, I'm sorry. 10:21. Then the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand toward the sky so that darkness will spread over Egypt. Darkness that can be felt. Moses stretched out his hand. Full darkness covered all of Egypt for 2 days. So there seems to be a structure and a pattern when we look at the way these nine plagues are arranged. The first plague in each set has a purpose for it, attached to it. And that's something we've already looked at. That's in 7:17, the purpose is, by this you will know that I am Yahweh. 8:22. On that day I will deal differently with the land of Goshen where my people live. No swarms of flies will be on them. Why? So that you will know that I, the Lord, am in this land. Purposeful. And 9:14. For this time I will send the full force of my plagues against you and against your officials and your people so that you may know there is no one like me in the whole world. The first three plagues, the water turned to blood, the frogs and the lice, convinced the magicians of Egypt, the sorcerers of Egypt, that there's more than magic involved in what is going on. God was at work. In 7:11, where all this starts, after the Lord had told Moses and Aaron in verse 8, throw your staff before the Pharaoh will become a snake. And they do that in verse 10. You read in verse 11. Pharaoh summoned the wise men and the sorcerers. The Egyptian magicians did the same things by their secret arts. Each one threw down his staff, it became a snake. So they kind of duplicated in some way what Moses and Aaron had done. But, disqualification, Aaron's staff swallowed up their staff. Yet Pharaoh's heart became hard and was not listened. But in 7, you have that. In 7:22, with the water turning to blood, you read in 7.2, the Egyptian magicians did the same things by their secret arts. Pharaoh's heart became hard. In 8.7, with the frogs, magicians did the same thing by their secret arts. They made frogs come up from the land of Egypt. But when you get to 8.18 with the gnats, you read, when the magicians tried to produce gnats by their secret arts, they couldn't. And the gnats were all men and animals. The magician said to Pharaoh, "This is the finger of God." The Pharaoh's heart was hard. He wouldn't listen. Just as the Lord had said. So after those first three, the magicians are convinced there's something here far more powerful than anything we're aware of. One more comment, we'll take our break. With the next six plagues, after those first three, with the possible exception of the locusts, because nothing is said for it, you find discrimination in the effects of the plague between the Egyptians and the Israelites. The Israelites are spared the effects of the plague, while the Egyptians are not. And I think the purpose there is to make very clear Yahweh here is working on behalf of his people. In 8:21-23, with the flies, you read, "If you do not let my people go, I will send swarms of flies on you and your officials, on your people, into your houses. The house of the Egyptians will be full of flies, even the ground where they are. But on that day, I will deal differently with the land of Goshen, where my people live. No swarms of flies will be there." Why? Again, so we will know that I, Yahweh, am in this land. I will make a distinction between my people and your people. So starting with the flies, you get that distinction, the discrimination. And you find that in 8:21-23 with the cattle in 9:4, 6, and 7. 9:4, the Lord will make a distinction between the livestock of Israel, that of Egypt. And you read in 6, all the livestock of the Egyptians died. Not one animal belonged to the Israelites died. You have it with the boils in 9:11. Magicians could not stand for Moses because of the boils that were on them and on all the Egyptians. You have it with the hail in 9:26. The only place that did not hail was the land of Goshen, where the Israelites were. As I mentioned, nothing said about the locusts one way or the other. But with the darkness in 10:23, you read, "No one could see anyone else or leave this place for 3 days, yet all the Israelites had lights in the places where they lived." So, certainly with five of those last six, there was this discrimination between the Egyptians and the Israelites, and perhaps with the locusts as well.